As the state reopens, Florida's family physicians say their piece about the COVID pandemic. Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, your family doctor is usually the first line of defense against COVID, and they've got some advice you can use right now. We'll speak with the president of the Florida Academy of Family Physicians. Give us a call. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later, why an appeals court struck down Jacksonville's human rights ordinance and what's next with that. But first this morning, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health reports 36,897 cases and 1,399 deaths. In Northeast Florida, there are 1,770 reported cases and 54 deaths. Two of the new deaths, a 67-year-old man and a 72-year-old woman, happened here in Duval County. Positive tests jumped by 27 in Duval County. That's the largest single day-to-day rise in department statistics for 2 weeks, the TU reports. The county had recorded 36 positive tests on April 20th, but four of the last 8 days had only seen new cases in the single digits. Now, this is important to talk about. Cases are jumping just as the state reopens, right? And family physicians are often the first line of healthcare providers patients turn to when they present with COVID-19 symptoms. Even though we're opening back up for business, this vital group of healthcare providers wants to stress the important message of staying safe, staying home, and wearing a mask when you go out. Dr. Christy Alexander is president of the Florida Academy of Family Physicians. She's also a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Rural Health at Florida State University's College of Medicine, and she's on the line. Dr. Alexander, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
And as coronavirus death tolls are predicted to nearly double by June, this is what we want to say to all of you out there. Here's our question to callers. How do you plan to go about your business now that Florida is opening back up? And what are your questions for the president of the Florida Academy of Family Physicians? Give us a call. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Okay, so this is a Jacksonville-based group, doctor, and you are often the doctors that really are the first person to see someone who thinks they might have coronavirus. What are you hearing from family physicians around the state right now?
Well, it's been a very interesting time for all of us, as you can imagine, and we are all working at this in different ways. So everyone's seeing it. Everyone's handling it a little bit differently depending on the structure of their practices, but we are all fully prepared to help our patients mitigate through what's happening with this pandemic.
Okay. And so what is the message you are saying right now to patients, and what do you want to communicate to the public right now?
So what we're saying is that if you're sick, please call before you go into your doctor's office and let them know your symptoms. Most offices can handle things by the phone at this point and put in orders for COVID testing if needed. That's been a big push, is to keep people safe, is to call before you come in, and hopefully we can get that testing done for you, especially now where tests are becoming more available. That's number one. And also, if you're feeling sick, to please don't associate with others. Now, on the other side of that, we're finding that there are asymptomatic cases everywhere, people that don't even know they have the virus. So the big message is to please, please, please continue to stay home and physically distance. I like that wording better than socially distance, because it better explains what we're doing, as much as possible. If you have to go out, please, we implore everyone that's out, whether you're a worker in a store or a somebody that's going into the store, to make sure you're wearing a mask. It not only protects you, but it protects those around you. Because, again, there are many asymptomatic people out there with the virus that just aren't aware that they even have it at this point, that could get somebody else very sick. So that's a biggie. And then good hand washing, as always. 20 minutes or 20 minutes.
20 seconds. Yeah, it feels like 20 minutes.
It does. Singing happy birthday twice is a really long time. But making sure that you're washing your hands with soap and water, or at least using a 60% alcohol-based hand sanitizer.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I tried singing Happy Birthday twice when washing my hands for 20 seconds. That didn't work for me, so my little song that I sing in my head is Stayin' Alive. I thought that made sense.
Ooh,
just the chorus. Just the chorus part, because that's about 20 seconds, but it does. It feels like 20 minutes when you're doing it. Because let's face it, most of us didn't wash our hands for that length of time before this crisis hit. And whether you're washing your hands, wearing a mask, social distancing, we want to hear from you as we speak with Dr. Christy Alexander, president of the Florida Academy of Family Physicians. She's based here in Jacksonville. She's also a professor at FSU. And as the state opens back up for business, family physicians are there for you. In fact, they're often the first healthcare provider people see if they think they might be dealing with COVID in their household. What are your questions for her? It's 549-2937 to join us. Now, let me ask you about this, doctor. On Monday, the Trump administration pushed back against an internal government report that was obtained by the New York Times. It predicts the daily coronavirus death toll could nearly double in the United States by early June. The number of deaths per day is expected to reach about 3,000 a day by June 1st. Nearly 70,000 people around the country have already died. And so we're looking at more than 100,000 people passing away from this. They're suggesting that by the end of June, the country would likely experience 200,000 new cases a day. What's your reaction to this, given that as people start going back into stores and restaurants, there's almost certain to be more cases, even if we continue social distancing and mask wearing here in Florida and teleworking? What about these new numbers?
I have to concur with the new numbers. When you think about what we've done so far, let's just put it into perspective. Let me throw out some numbers here. So we have tested 445,995 people, and yes, we have 36,000 positive, which is 36,897 people who are positive, giving an 8.3% overall percent positive rate currently. Sounds not so bad, right? But we have 21.48 million people in the state of Florida. If you do that math, only 2% have been tested. So we really need to look at these percentages in a different way, because we have to make sure of what we're looking at. The data just doesn't play out. It's actually 0.02%. My apologies. My math is a little bit off there. Mm-hmm. So we have to be looking at this and realizing we haven't done enough tests to even realize how far spread this is in our state, much less the nation. So until we get more, until we do more testing and include contact tracing and things like that, we just don't know where we stand. So opening up now and making it seem like everything's okay to some extent, it's just not true. And we have to realize that fact. And we have to also realize that we have no treatment, no vaccine, and therefore we have no way to mitigate the thing when it starts to become more severe.
The governor, Ron DeSantis, and Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry have worked to increase testing, both here in Jacksonville and at points around the state. We're also hearing Florida may unroll additional access to serology or antibody tests so people can determine whether or not they've already had the virus and are now have some sort of immunity to it. But as you pointed out, we're still dealing with only a fraction of the population that's being tested. We don't have any significant contact tracing. Other nations have done a much better job than the United States of this, and that is just the fact of the matter. How frustrated are you by this, that we're not seeing the kind of widespread testing and tracing that we need to better deal with this pandemic and resolve the economic issues that we're facing currently?
It's extremely frustrating because, of course, we want everybody to get back to work. We really do. It's not about keeping people home. We want people to get back to work and be healthy at the same time. That's our number one hope for all of us. The thing is, without all the testing, we're shooting blind. So people get, we live in a hurricane state. If you think about where, you know, hurricane tracking and the cone of uncertainty, we're living in the cone of uncertainty right now, completely living in it. And it's just extremely frustrating to know that we're basing economic decisions on math that doesn't play out because we don't have enough testing to know exactly what's going on.
Let's go to some calls now for Dr. Christy Alexander. Based here in Jacksonville, she's president of the Florida Academy of Family Physicians. Have you seen a family doctor recently for COVID or any other matter? What are your questions? 549-2937. Carolyn in Jacks Beach. Hi, Carolyn. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, doctor, for your comment about language. I think that the language social isolation and social distancing is old-fashioned pandemic language and that public health needs to update itself because most of us, if we don't want to be socially isolated, we can be socially connected even though physically separate. And I think there's an unintended negative consequence that when people hear be socially isolated and socially distant, that they start to feel depressed and smaller, and that we can change the mood by changing the word.
Mm. Okay, Carolyn. Yeah, thank you. The language we use is important, doctor. What about her comment there?
I absolutely love that comment. It is so true. And we're going to start seeing more and more cases of depression, anxiety, things like that because of that feeling of isolation. When in fact, if we change the language and talk about staying socially connected, which is so easy for us to do these days with social media and iPads and FaceTime and Zoom now, that we don't have to be socially distant. We just have to stay physically apart, if that makes sense.
Right. Maybe saying stay socially connected would be a little more encouraging. Maybe we should all try doing that. 549-2937, Ray in Orange Park. Hello, Ray.
Hello. I just got a couple of minor questions. I am 64 years old, trying to get in to see the doctor because I don't know if I got issues, but I got some symptoms, but I'm unable to get into the office to speak with the doctor. The only thing they do is just call me up and give me results over about my blood tests and everything, which is not really what I want. I'm paying big money for insurance. And on the second question is, it also works with dental. You know, we can't get in to get our teeth worked on, and, you know, what are we supposed to do? We're paying all this insurance. Are they going to reimburse us, or what's going to happen?
Yeah, that is a great question, Ray, and thanks for your call about that. This is a common issue many patients are having, doctor. What about dental procedures that you can't have right now or other procedures that you're paying insurance for and that you have to put off?
Right, and as far as the reimbursement, I'm not sure about that piece of it, but I can say that elective procedures have been opening back up. During this time that everything's been closed, it's allowed certain offices to prepare themselves for reopening. And so hopefully dental clinics are doing the same as we are in our medical family medicine offices. So in regards to not being able to get in with your physician, I'm curious to see if there's any way to call and let them know that you're having symptoms, maybe get them to force the issue a little bit. Also, what's happening across the state, that there are certain centers that are opening up that you don't even need an order to get tested. So it may be worth looking into that as well. I'm actually based in Leon County, so my apologies for the confusion there. And I can say in Leon County, we now have a stadium that's open and is testing up to 300 people a day, mm-hmm. No order needed. You can just walk on the stadium field and get tested, and the results are sent to the health department.
Right.
So I think they're going to start opening those sorts of things up across the entire state, and then you don't even need an order from your physician. You can just go and get tested.
Sure. And if you're still listening out there, Ray, you can come and get tested downtown at TIAA Bank Field with no doctor's note. They're taking hundreds of people a day at that testing site, have been for several weeks now, and there are lots of other testing sites around the community. Russell in Mandarin. Hi, Russell.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I believe that the American people have really responded well to this lockdown, and the lockdown is meant to give us time, to give our government time, not only to build up stores to respond to the virus, but also to to not overwhelm our healthcare system. And the lockdown has worked for that. The American people have done their part. Our government has failed us right across the board, from the White House on to, down onto many of the states. Now, we don't have enough testing in Florida. We don't know how many people are carrying this virus. Of course, you know, you can make statistics say whatever you want them to say. And the reason that positive result tests have risen is because, you know, tests have risen. There are a lot more people out there that are carrying this virus. I'd like to ask the doctor, how dangerous do you think it is to reopen the state in the condition that we are in? And again, right from the White House to the state, we are being lied to about the availability of testing. And wow, how long can the American people be expected to do their part and watch the government fail us?
Yeah, Russell, thanks for that. I think there are so many out there that share that point of view. So, Doctor, what about that?
First of all, those are some fantastic points. You're right. It's not the bottom line numbers that matter. It's just the overall sense that we don't have enough testing to know what's going on. And getting mixed messages left and right makes it even more confusing for everybody involved. I also agree that our American public has done a fabulous job with the stay-home orders. You see people taking it seriously all the time, to the point that now that things are even reopening, I can tell you there are businesses that are, some of the restaurants and things that are allowed to reopen aren't, because they know that it's dangerous. So knowing that our businesses are heeding these warnings and taking them very, very seriously is very reassuring, because while it might sound nice that we can reopen the state to the point of allowing restaurants to have a certain capacity and things like that, the danger is still there. It's still very much there. And if you've ever been around anybody, it's really hard to stay away 6 feet apart.
It's
really, really hard.
It's tough. Every time I go to the grocery store, there's no way that's happening.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, what about his,
point
that he feels that the American people are doing their part, but the government is not doing its part? What do you think of that point?
Oh, gosh, it's such a mixed bag, because I know the government has a sense of responsibility to the economy, which is different than my responsibility to the health of the public. So that's really, really a tough balance, and I get it. But at the same time, the misinformation around what's actually happening around the virus makes it confusing. So from that end, it would just be nice if we had one message that was consistent with good factual information from here on out, because then everybody could wrap their head around what's really going on and do the right thing.
Do you advise people to not go into stores, not go eat in a restaurant, even though they can now? Or what do you advise them to do?
I do. My first thing is to say, stay home if you can. If you don't have to go to a restaurant, take curbside carryout. If you're trying to support your local restaurants, do a curbside thing, a pickup thing, or have it delivered, and then you can clean everything off before you bring it into the house, something like that. If it's about supporting the economy, there are things we can do. If you have to go to the store, if you're not able to do like the delivery options that stores have now for food or for medications and things like that, just make it quick and make it simple. And if you're ill, send somebody else out for you. And everybody out there needs to be wearing a mask in that situation and staying as far away as possible from those around you when you're in the store. Very hard to do.
Sure. Speaking of that, Doctor, here's a comment on our Facebook page from Gina. Why don't merchants require masks for people coming into their establishments? That's up to the individual business, right?
It is. We would love to see that enforced. I know that nobody loves the word mandatory or enforcement when it comes to anything regarding our freedom, but it would be nice if it were required during this time. Let me just put it that way. If it were required just during this time until we know exactly what we're dealing with, especially places like grocery stores where people have to go to get food and supplies and things like that. So it would be nice that just everybody wear a mask, both in the store and those going into the store.
Here's a tweet.
Those working at the store and going into the store.
Sure. Here's a tweet from a listener. One of the untold stories of COVID is that everyone doesn't fully recover right away. There are reports of numerous long-term health issues from those who beat the virus. There's still a lot we don't know, he says. All right, let's go to Peter in St. Augustine. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi. To piggyback quickly on a couple of things real fast, the idea of messaging or language, this word lockdown is so severe sounding. I wish there were a better way to incorporate maybe what the economic or business interests are, but linked to the necessity to be safe and have distance or something. Sometimes I feel the word lockdown excludes a large group of people, and there is an economic reality to this. But my primary reason for calling is I was so disappointed in hearing the governor this morning, or if it was yesterday, saying that we were right and everyone else was wrong in terms of opening Jacksonville beaches, as if this is some debate we're having rather than we're trying to ensure everyone's safety. It was just very disappointing to hear him say that. And I'm raising a 14-year-old daughter. It was the wrong thing to hear in trying to convince her that people need to be safe. Thank you.
Peter, thank you. Dr. Alexander.
That's a great comment. I think that's one of the hardest populations right now are the kids, the teenagers that want to get out and about, get back to their regular lives, and the beaches are opening and it's beautiful weather out and we're saying, no, you can't go. It's really, really tough. I'm hearing that a lot from friends that have teenagers or that age group children, and it's mixed messaging again, because it's exactly what he said. It's not about who's right and who's wrong. It's about keeping people healthy and not seeing these numbers go up too soon. A little bit longer on the stay-home orders, a little bit longer before we started to reopen things, just until we get a handle on what the numbers actually are, would have been better.
Cecilia in St. Augustine. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi. Thank you so much for this topic. I really appreciate it. The reason I was calling is I've already lost two family members to COVID. Sorry, I get emotional.
Oh, I'm so sorry. And who were they?
They were my uncle and my cousin. I'm originally from New York.
Okay.
And they're still there. But I know they traveled down here in the time that they were possibly ill. But my big thing is, and I'm personally immunocompromised, so I'm on quarantine for the next month, even continuing, and I have a teenager and a 8-year-old. But I'm concerned about the governor saying that medical examiners are not allowed to discuss the numbers of deaths coming out of the offices. He has put a lockdown on, saying medical examiners cannot really give the COVID death numbers. And so that's really, really disquieting to me.
Right. And that has been widely reported, Cecilia. And I'm so sorry about your family losses. Dr. Alexander, what about that, that we really don't, frankly, have an accurate count here in this state?
Thank you. I am so sorry to hear about that. So, so sorry indeed. That's devastating. And the fact that you have to remain quarantined is even harder. What I would say to that is, it's very difficult to know exactly, is that even really happening? It's in regards to, is he truly mandating that medical examiner's offices not release that information? I've heard differing rumors about that, stories about that. And if that is true, that is going to do us a disservice, again, because we're not going to know what the actual numbers are. And I don't really understand if it is true. I personally don't understand the point of that. Is in regards to trying to make ourselves look better, I'm not sure. I don't understand it if it's true. Hopefully it's not, because again, it'll give us a better idea of what's going on in our state if we have the actual data. And that's all we need, because then we can make some real tangible decisions for our economy and for the health of the people.
What are your final thoughts to give out to folks out there who are trying to keep themselves and their families safe as we enter this new phase?
I would just say, as I said earlier, to continue the stay-home orders for now, knowing that we don't know as much as we need to know about this virus. Things are changing all the time. I'm sure you guys have talked about the symptoms that have been added to the list from the CDC for coronavirus. Even things like that we're reporting now, It's ever-changing. Again, the cone of uncertainty. We don't know what's going to happen. The numbers fluctuate from day to day. And it's not to scare people, by the way. I'm not trying to fearmonger. I'm just saying that it's important to know that there's a lot we don't know. And so because of that, it's best to continue staying home and staying socially connected, as we decided. And if you do have to go out, making sure that you are wearing a mask, making sure you're maintaining that 6 feet and really paying attention to that 6 feet, and then immediately after, making sure you're practicing good hand washing in that as well.
Let's all keep it up.
And to know that we are all here for you. Your family docs are here for you. And I'm sorry for those of you that are having trouble getting through to see your doctor or to talk to your doctor. We are all here for you and doing the best we can to get back with you because we care about you.
That is so good to hear. Don't be hesitant to reach out to your family doctor and take Dr. Alexander's advice. Keep up the hand washing, the mask wearing, the 6 feet apart, and order takeout if you can. Keep up what we've been doing. I know how weary we all are of this, but as she is saying, we really need to keep at it for a while longer. And I want to thank you so much. She's Dr. Christy Alexander, president of the Florida Academy of Family Physicians. Doctor, thanks for your insights.
Thank you so much for having me this morning. I really appreciate it.
Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, how you can support WJCT and Giving Tuesday now, today. But up next.
It means that they believe the council didn't have enough information in front of it to vote for the HRO.
What is going on with Jacksonville's human rights ordinance? We've got an explainer after this.
Introducing the Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT, offering music lovers a variety of ways to enjoy favorite artists and discover new genres. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today.
Public radio is where you turn for critical information and updates about the coronavirus pandemic. But we also make sure to bring you moments of beauty and peace.
And Hirata said one thing was certain, the tree would still bloom. He pointed to small red buds. They're starting, he said, just a few days away.
Help us bring you these moments. Make your Giving Tuesday Now gift to this station.
Text the word GIVE 899 to 44321, and thank you.
Welcome back. Well, there's a big piece of non-COVID related news making headlines this week, Jacksonville's Human Rights Ordinance, or HRO. Last week, an appeals court struck down the ordinance because even though it had been updated 3 years ago and expanded to cover LGBTQ citizens, they said the legislation was apparently not written out properly. The updated measure was passed into law in 2017 after a long battle. As I said, it did add LGBTQ residents as a protected class in this city from discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Jacksonville attorney Jimmy Midyette was the legislative director of the Jacksonville Coalition for Equality at the time and helped write the ordinance. He's also now a candidate for Duval County Clerk of Courts. We spoke with him.
The law was passed and enacted in 2017. The opponents of the ordinance immediately sued. They were thrown out of court twice by Judge Weatherby, and then they appealed that ruling from Judge Weatherby to the appeals court, and the appeals court agreed with their interpretation of the notice requirement that say it wasn't met properly. It means that they believe the council didn't have enough information in front of it to vote for the HRO, and that the public of Jacksonville didn't have enough information about the HRO.
So what's exactly happening here and what can we expect next? John Harris Maurer is Public Policy Director of Equality Florida, and he's on the line. John Harris, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your questions about this latest twist in Jacksonville's human rights ordinance? We'll go to your calls in a moment. The number to join us, 549-2937. So, John Harris, we're not really sure right now if we have the human rights ordinance that was passed into law 3 years ago. What is the current legal status of this group of citizens in Jacksonville?
Well, Friday's ruling does not immediately strike down the ordinance. So today that ordinance remains in full effect. And what we know is that it has been in effect for 3 years, even as these challenges have gone on. And Jacksonville is only better for it. Jacksonville has really moved past the question of whether or not to establish these protections. It's been in place for 3 years and it's working well. So we know that the decision on Friday from the appellate court presents some new questions and maybe new challenges, but we're happy with where Jacksonville has been, and we're really thrilled to see, you know, how open and welcoming it has been and just how supported folks feel in Jacksonville. You know, we have on the order of 30,000 members of Equality Florida in the Jacksonville and Duval County area. So we know just how important these protections are to them.
Right. And so understandably, this group has concerns about this. What's the rationale behind the appeals court? They're saying that the measure wasn't written out properly. Who's to blame for that in your view?
Well, I don't know about ascribing blame, but this is really just a procedural issue that the court has flagged. Equality Florida certainly has and continues to disagree with that analysis. If you look at the notice that the court was discussing, it makes very clear just what the city council was debating. And we know that this was a very long discussed measure, as you mentioned in your opening.
It went on for years and years. Yeah.
Yeah. Fully on notice of what we were talking about here. But I think it's also important that really the court didn't find that this human rights ordinance violated constitutional freedom of speech or freedom of religion arguments that the opponents, Liberty Council, have tried to lodge against the HRO. We know that with the passage in Jacksonville, now 60% of Floridians are covered by these sort of local protections for housing, employment, and public spaces. And in this moment that we find ourselves with the COVID-19 epidemic, we know just how vital these protections are, especially as people are really struggling with employment issues and making sure that they can provide for themselves and their families. Those are really difficult, and we want to make sure that everybody in Florida has the same fair opportunity across the board, including in employment, and that's why these sort of protections are so important.
Right. So for people who haven't followed this closely, what this ordinance means is you can't be fired from a job or denied a job. You can't be kicked out of an apartment, for example, simply for being gay. You can't be denied housing or employment based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Can't be refused service in a restaurant, that type of thing. So have you been in touch with Jacksonville officials since this ruling came about?
You know, we've been in contact with the Jacksonville City Attorney's Office and have certainly seen some of the comments they've already made in the press about the ruling. But I won't say that we have any insider intel on where the city will go from here. We know that this ordinance was passed, as we said, after a lot of really hard work, in a 12-6 vote by wide margin under a Republican-controlled city council. And these protections are really valued. So we're encouraged that it looks like the city is very committed to ensuring that these protections can remain in place. But how that happens is an open question.
Right. People on the city council have said they now need to go to the Office of General Counsel, that's City Attorney Jason Gabriel, to evaluate all legal options, maybe take this to the Florida Supreme Court. This has been kicked back to a trial judge. And so, you know, these legal maneuvers are complicated for the average person to follow. But, you know, what is the next legal move for this? What's next? What can we expect next?
Sure. I mean, there are a couple of options for the city's response here. And I would say that two primary ones. which you touched on a bit, are first, the city could appeal this ruling to the Florida Supreme Court in the same way that the trial court originally found in favor of our side, to put it simply, and then that was appealed to this court that ruled on Friday. There is another level of review, and that would be the Florida Supreme Court, and it's really the city's prerogative as to whether or not they will appeal up to the Florida Supreme Court. Certainly, as I mentioned, Equality Florida and our terrific partners at Jacksonville Coalition for Equality are very dedicated to ensuring that these protections remain in place. The other primary option would be for the city to readopt the HRO. So that would involve, you know, following along with the appellate court's guidance on procedures and going through the routine legislative process that the city council has.
And of course, right now, with everything being done remotely and this pandemic, it might take a little longer than before to legislatively accomplish that. What are your thoughts about how all of this factors in, given what we're dealing with the COVID crisis?
Sure. I think it is a bit of a new world for us in organizing, but it's not anything that we're entirely unfamiliar with. And we've already had some successes really in this new environment. Just now last month, the city of Tallahassee passed an ordinance establishing protections for against conversion therapy. And that was a campaign that had been going on for really months with local organizers. And we were really pleased to see that the city was still willing to move forward with it after things had shut down and been suspended for a little while due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But the city knew that it was a big priority and they put it back on the agenda. So, you know, we've looked at remote meetings and testifying by Zoom is a little different, but it's nothing insurmountable. And certainly a policy like Jacksonville's HRO is so incredibly important. We've seen how well it works that we're prepared to, you know, adapt and respond however necessary.
We have a tweet from a listener saying, I know that Equality Florida doesn't want to assign blame, but the way the ordinance was written for simplicity's sake was just the wrong way to go about it. The ordinance was written very simply, not a lot of language. In hindsight, was that a mistake?
You know, while the language was simple, I think the objective and the ordinance itself is pretty simple too. Really, we're talking about defining two terms and then adding them wherever these enumerated categories exist. So if you're talking about protections for other classifications like gender, race, national origin, religion, we should add sexual orientation and gender identity there as well. I don't think that's a really hard concept to understand. It's an important one and it's worth discussion. That's why we spent years doing education on it and had so many of these discussions. We saw, you know, town hall forums on it. So I don't mean to minimize the importance of it by saying that it's straightforward, but I don't think we're talking about something that was incredibly complex and obscure for folks to understand from that notice.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with John Harris Marr, Public Policy Director of Equality Florida, as an appellate court has tossed Jacksonville's human rights ordinance. It may go to the Florida Supreme Court or another legal venue. And let me ask you, John Harris, you mentioned a few minutes ago that about 60% of Florida residents are covered under these types of human rights ordinances from discrimination based on their identity. I know that Equality Florida has been working for years to get a statewide measure passed that would be 100% of all Florida residents could not be discriminated against in jobs, housing, or public accommodations. That has gone before the legislature several times, has not passed. Can you bring us up to date on your efforts at the legislative level in Tallahassee?
Sure. So as you mentioned, we have had great success at the local level, partnering with local organizations that have really been the boots on the ground in helping establish these policies. Certainly a massive effort like we saw in Jacksonville, but even more recently in Fernandina Beach and really across the state. But while we've had that success, it does create a patchwork of protections, as you noted, where only 60% of Floridians enjoy these sort of protections. So the statewide uniformity that we've been pushing for is a bill called the Florida Competitive Workforce Act. And again, very simply, this would just be an update to the existing Florida Civil Rights Act to add sexual orientation and gender identity wherever it's enumerating categories for protection. So again, wherever you're talking about things like race, national origin, we think that sexual orientation and gender identity should also be included there. Unfortunately, as you noted, we wrapped up another legislative session recently, and the bill didn't get a hearing. And it is very frustrating to see that lack of movement when we have such a strong level of support for these protections. You know, we had a great bipartisan team of leadership in the House advancing it, a strong Senate sponsor. Ultimately, the Florida Competitive Workforce Act was the most co-sponsored bill in the process. So that's not just folks telling us in closed-door meetings that they would vote for it if it comes up for a vote, but folks that actually want to put their names on this legislation. The highest number of senators signed on that we've ever had. So some great milestones, but it does remain a real challenge there. We know the support is there. Again, we've seen this great upswell from local communities adopting these sort of policies. We have terrific support in the faith community, much as we saw the faith community come out really importantly around the Jacksonville HRO, similarly with the business coalitions, both in Jacksonville and at the state level. There's an organization called Florida Compete. That's more than 450 major Florida businesses that all support these policies because they know, as we've seen in Jacksonville, that these sort of protections help them attract and retain top talent and make them more competitive. There are businesses that say, you know, we've put these policies in place. They work well for us. They're beneficial, and we want Florida to be able to compete similarly.
Well, we're going to have to continue to follow this, and I want to thank you for your thoughts because it's been a long and winding road, hasn't it, in Jacksonville? And the journey isn't over yet when it comes to this city's human rights ordinance. We'll continue to follow it both on the air and online at WJCT.org as an appeals court has struck down the city's HRO. And we're going to see where this goes next. And we want to thank you so much for your insights. He's John Harris Maurer, Public Policy Director for Equality Florida, on the line for us. Thanks so much, John Harris.
Thanks for having me.
A quick break, and in a moment, how you can help support WJCT or your nonprofit of choice today. Today is Giving Tuesday. Yeah, check out the hashtag Giving Tuesday now while we go to break. And in a moment, our CEO, David McGowan, will join us. That's in a minute here on First Coast Connect. We'll be right back.
This crisis is disproportionately hitting communities of color, and that's true even where the money is, like venture capital.
You have to build these networks from the ground up in order to get in the room and to get in these spaces, and now it's like we have to start all over there.
I'm Kai Rizdal, investing in the underestimated, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about depression and how it may be triggered by the pandemic, My guest will be humorist John Moe, whose new memoir is called The Hilarious World of Depression, which is also the title of his podcast, in which he talks with comics, musicians, and writers about their depression. He's been dealing with depression since seventh grade. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
How many Americans are getting a good night's sleep? Nowadays, not many. And if you're finding your dreams have been a little weird lately, you're not alone. The rupture in our routine is making it hard for millions to get their heads down at night. I'm Sarah McCammon, in search of better sleep, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Public Radio brings you knowledge every day, and we're committed to being here for you no matter what tomorrow's news brings. You power that commitment when you give to this station now. Here's how.
Donate to WJCT today. Go to wjct.org/radio, and thank you.
Welcome back. Well, here's a question. Is your home or office in need of a serious cleaning after weeks of quarantine? My house sure is. Now, this is a question on many minds. We asked an expert about how you can get a cleaning done safely. Here's Chandler St. Peter of ServPro of Jacksonville.
Generally, the CDC has a protocol that calls out exactly what needs to be done step for step, and it's pretty similar for every application in every home. It's a pretty standard protocol that we follow. So if it's a proactive cleaning, they call for a high touch point cleaning only. So that means, you know, countertops, bathrooms, anything that's constantly being touched surface-wise, whether it be in a commercial building, doorknobs, you know, inside the bathrooms, countertops, desktops, computers, phones. If it's your home, then essentially basically everything that you could possibly touch. Now, if it's a confirmed case cleaning, protocol's a little bit more in-depth. We go in and we do a high touch point cleaning or horizontal surface cleaning to remove any dust. Then we'll go in and we fog or use electrostatic sprayers to cover the surface.
That was Chandler St. Peter of ServPro of Jax. Happy cleaning, everyone. Well, today is Giving Tuesday now. And due to the coronavirus pandemic, the folks behind Giving Tuesday, a campaign that usually takes place in November, have created a second campaign to help nonprofits that are working to maintain funding during this time. That includes WJCT. We are essential workers in this pandemic. Our CEO, David McGowan, is on the phone with more. Hey, David.
Hey, Melissa. How are you? Great to be with you this morning and with you and your listeners.
It's great to have you on the show as well. Let's begin, if you could, by explaining to folks out there how WJCT has been impacted by the pandemic.
Well, of course, just like every workplace, Melissa, we've been impacted, as you well know, by working remotely. Almost all of our employees are working from home or working from other locations. But I'm really proud to say that we've been able to recommit ourselves and kind of double down on some of the things that we think are most important to do for our community right now, whether that is in the field of public affairs and information, your program, you and your team providing what's, I think, one of the most important forms for public information right now. We've created a stay-at-home, learn-at-home education service for students and teachers who are out of their classrooms right now. And we've also created a new entertainment service in the form of the Jacksonville Music Experience, which, among other things, has provided a way for musicians to stay visible during the time when they can't perform in public settings. So we've really been able to rise to the occasion in spite of having our workplace, you know, impacted just as everyone else has.
Right. And I encourage everyone to check out the Jacksonville Music Experience online. It is just fantastic right there on our website at wjct.org. So if people donate today to WJCT on this Giving Tuesday, they will be supporting all of these efforts. They can donate right on our website or text Give WJCT to 44321. And I'll mention that again before we sign off, David. But we also, you know, on our website have a dedicated coronavirus site. So we're keeping pace with all of the pandemic information people need too.
We sure are. And, you know, one of the ways that we've been impacted, which I didn't mention right at the beginning, is, of course, one of our major forms of revenue has been significantly impacted. You know, we're very grateful to our supporters. WJCT has a terrific pool of individual supporters, and for the most part, they have remained with us and continue to share with us in a very generous way. But corporate support, which is about a third of our revenue, has really dried up very quickly. As you can imagine, many businesses are struggling. We understand that, and we understand that they may not just have the ability to get their message out in the same way that they did, you know, a couple of months ago. And so that's a form of revenue that we've really seen, you know, all but disappear. And so Giving Tuesday really is an opportunity for our supporters to help fill that gap and continue to allow us to provide all of these essential services.
And I know you want to make a quick mention of Rescan Day for people who still use rabbit ears to get our signal.
Yes, indeed. And thank you for mentioning that, Melissa. On May 1st, just the last Friday, according to an FCC mandate, we were required to change the frequency that we broadcast on. And that requires people who receive our signal, our television signal, through an antenna to rescan their television set. And we know that some people have had some problems either doing that process or receiving our signal after they complete a rescan. And if they have that problem, I just want to urge them to go onto our website. There's a rescan page. They can receive instructions on how to go through that process. But also, if they're continuing to experiencing difficulty in their reception, they can give us information and particularly give us their zip code so that we can help identify the source of the problem and follow up with them.
Definitely get in touch with us about that. And to donate on this Giving Tuesday, just go to WJCT.org. You'll see the red donate button right there on our homepage up at the top on the right side. You can make a one-time gift or a monthly sustaining donation. And you can text Give WJCT to 44321 if you want to make a donation by text. He is our CEO, David McGowan. Thanks for hopping on the phone on this Giving Tuesday. David, we look forward to seeing you in person soon.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers and to producer Heather Schatz and director Josh Torres, plus station news director Jessica Palumbo and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. If you missed anything, our podcast is online at WJCT.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Looking forward to connecting with you again at 9 a.m. Wednesday. Stay calm and keep flattening the curve, even though we're all heading back out into the world. Talk to you soon.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.